Hi, guys. Thank you for your continued support of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I also wanted to take a moment and thank two of our wonderful podcast sponsors. The first is Thrive Market. Thrive is a new online marketplace offering the world's best-selling natural and organic products at wholesale prices. If Costco and Whole Foods Online got together at a rave and got liquored up, their child would look a lot like Thrive Market. So the way that Thrive works, for less than $5 a month, about $59.95 annually, you get a membership that gives you access to more than 2,500 of the highest quality food, supplement, home, personal care, and beauty products. Those are all delivered straight to your door and at 25 to 50% below retail price. Orders above $49 are free, but that's only in the continental United States. RobWolf.com followers get a free two-month Thrive Market membership, as well as 20% off of your first order. So go to thrivemarket.com/RobWolf, and you can get in on that deal. Our second podcast sponsor is Hylete. Hylete creates an innovative performance apparel that captures the spirit of the hybrid athlete. I was an early adopter of the Hylete products and really, really like what they've done in the performance apparel scene. They're inviting all of my listeners to create a Powered by Hylete athlete account. This will give you preferred pricing, free shipping and returns, as well as exclusive offers from Hylete. To create that account, visit Hylete.com/RobWolf. Thanks again. Now it's time for the show. Hi, folks. Rob Wolf here. Another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Today, we have possibly our most prolific guest on the show. He's the guy that knows your gut better than you do, Dr. Michael Ruscio. Doc, how are you doing?
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me back. I'm good. How are you?
Oh, fantastic. We were jibby-jabbering for quite a bit before recording, and probably 90% of it should have been recorded and used for part of the show.
But I know.
So what's new with you? What's happening? You have some new information or maybe some clarifications on non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
Yeah, I wanted to maybe throw out a few clarifying points on that because I recently released a post on a study showing that IBS may be caused by non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and there's a really well-performed randomized control trial. And a lot of people commented on the post that, oh, I thought that IBS was caused by SIBO. And it is true, but it's not to say that that the only cause of IBS is from SIBO. And so I thought it might be a good chance to kind of zoom us way out and cover IBS and SIBO and the interplay there, and then also non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and kind of pick into, is that legit? Is it not legit? Is it really FODMAPs? Is it not FODMAPs? And how do we kind of sort all this stuff out?
Cool. Cool. Sounds good. We just had a dinner guest over, and the gal, really nice gal. She's in the media, and of course, things ended up, you know, steering over to food. And she was like, so I just thought that, you know, this gluten sensitivity is all made up. Like, that's what the headlines were saying. And I was like, oh, mother of God, give me another cocktail. So yeah, let's talk about this.
Well, I mean, you make a good point about sensationalist headlines. And I think we see a lot of that in our space because, I mean, let's just call it what it is. Information in a lot of this space is marketing, right? And so people just need to take a piece of information, give it an attractive, sensationalist spin. And that's why I think we see so much garbage on the internet, because you don't get highly truthful things in a lot of cases. You get things that are picked apart for sensationalism or spun one way for sensationalism. And then Mary Sue sitting at home goes online trying to figure out what to do for her IBS. And she sees some people saying that gluten is the devil and can do everything from ruin your gut to your love life. And then on the other side, people are saying that's complete BS because, you know, either endpoint sells well, but a more conservative, you know, perspective looking at all the evidence and coming up with a reasonable recommendation isn't quite as sexy.
Right, right. Absolutely. So, you know, talk a little bit about IBS itself. I'm sure virtually everybody is kind of familiar with IBS in theory, but I mean, one of the interesting things is that it is a syndrome. It's got a variety of different manifestations. Some people have diarrhea, some people have constipation, some people cycle between diarrhea and constipation. So maybe the fact that that is so variable might not be surprising that there are a multitude of inputs that might influence this.
Right. Yeah. And that's why this really is kind of an exclusion of diagnosis and a diagnosis of a constellation of symptoms. But some of the most common ones that we see are gas, bloating, abdominal pain, and altered bowel function. That could be constipation. It could be diarrhea. It could be an oscillation between the two. Dr. Pimentel likes to use the term they are regularly irregular.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the textbook examples of what IBS constitutes. And there can also be things that are melded in with that, like reflux, heartburn, flatulence. And then, of course, there can be this whole interesting world of all these extra-intestinal or non-intestinal manifestations. I actually just had a patient sent me a study through Twitter a little while ago about using a elemental diet in the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. And they use an elemental diet, which is just like a liquid diet. They use that next to prednisone to induce remission in rheumatoid arthritis. And it was shown to be the elemental diet was shown to be as effective as the prednisone, the anti-inflammatory drug. So we see that the gut can have really powerful influences on lots of things outside of the gut. And I'm sure everyone listening already kind of gets that.
And you know, with that elemental diet, correct me if I'm wrong, but part of the goal there is that it's a super low residue diet. So we're not really, we're supplying things that theoretically should be digested super early in the small intestine. There's not much left over that could be feeding bacteria, which on the one hand, we could argue is bad because we're decreasing mucosal layer and all that type of stuff. But for an acute therapeutic intervention, looks like it's good.
Yes, I think framing it that way is the best way to frame it, which is these lower carb, these lower fiber, these lower prebiotic sort of interventions tend to be very helpful for kind of our frontline therapy. Someone's really sick, they're not feeling well, they're having a flare, they're inflamed, there's some sort of overt pathology that needs to kind of be quelled. These tend to work really well in those applications. And the elemental diet, as you put, is exactly that. It's a liquid diet that absorbs just in the first few feet of the small intestine. And so the rest of the intestinal tract is unburdened by having to digest or to work. And that can be very anti-inflammatory. It can also be very reparative. The analogy I like to use with my patients is if you sprained your ankle and had to run 3 miles every day, how long would it take for your ankle to heal? Right. So if your gut is all inflamed and you're putting food particles through the gut every day, that can cause problems if the intestines are damaged, to put it loosely, then it may take longer to heal. Whereas if you were to take a break, if you will, a liquid break, or that'd be analogous to just sitting on the couch and elevating your ankle for a while, then you could facilitate healing much more quickly.
Right, right. I just had a bout with some sort of gut bug. I got traveling and ended up needing to do flagyl and all kinds of stuff for that. And, you know, normally I eat a reasonably fat-rich diet, still throw some carbs in there, but, you know, I definitely get the preponderance of my calories from fat. And while my gut was irritated, fat was a horrible idea. And it was a horrible idea for about a month after being sick. Like I was, graham crackers, rice crackers, white potatoes blended and pureed with no fat added to it. Like that was basically what I could tolerate because that stuff tends to digest much earlier in the GI tract.
Right. And that's maybe where the rice diet comes from for diarrhea, which is, I believe it's rice, it's the Brat diet. Bread, rice, applesauce, and toast. And I would throw out there maybe gluten-free toast, but I guess that's something we can pick into here in a minute. And right. I think for your gut health, Rob, avoiding brothels in the future would probably be a good idea.
I look at it as an immune challenge, but it also a tax write-off. So, you know, there's multiple benefits there. So talk to us a little bit more about gluten sensitivity. There was a study that was done, I don't know, maybe a year ago now that, you know, Fasano commented on it.
The University of Monash study?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I did a write-up on it. It was interesting. It maybe was talking about FODMAPs. I didn't get in too much about the fact that, you know, like the control diets had dairy in it, and we know that dairy is a cross-reactor with gluten potentially and whatnot, gluten sensitivity. Walk us through some of that.
Sure. Well, there's one or two lead-in points, more so overarching philosophical points that I think may just help people with how to think through some of this stuff. So we have to be careful with anecdotal reporting, right? Because there's always an extreme risk of bias. We can definitely learn things from anecdotal reporting, but going on message boards and chat rooms, it's not always going to be the best information because, again, it has a super high risk of anecdotal reporting or bias. The other thing we have to be careful with is clinicians who are making comments that in my clinical experience, I see X, Y, and Z, that certainly can also be very valuable. But if the clinician is biased and the clinician is expecting everyone in their office to do really well from a gluten-free diet, then you can see a real biasing of the quote-unquote clinical experience. So I think it's important for us to be aware of those so that when you're getting information from someone, you have your feelers out to say, does this person feel like they are just so jazzed on this idea that they're totally biasing themselves into, you know, placeboing these relationships or these findings?
Right.
And the other thing that I always try to do when looking at these things is when there's a controversy, and in many issues there are controversies, there's rarely unanimous agreement on one side of an issue. When there's controversies, I try to approach these things clinically or set my clinical model up in a way that minimizes risk and maximizes benefit to the patient should that controversy be disproven or proven, you know, depending on what side of the issue that you're on. Does that kind of make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great point.
So then with the gluten-free piece, just a final kind of philosophical point, you know, what is the potential harm that we can do? Like how can we kind of mitigate risk with this whole thing? Well, there's not, a lot of harm that can be vectored from someone going on a gluten-free diet physiologically, but I think it's actually more so financial and psychological. If someone does not need to avoid gluten and they're kind of fear-factored into thinking that they do, that can create a lot of social stress for that person, right? This is the person who goes to a wedding or a family event.
They become me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And now some people have to be that way, right? Some people clearly just can't do it. But other people will suffer with this internal conflict and turmoil, and they may not need to in all cases. And so that's one of the harms that if we're too overzealous about recommending a gluten-free diet that can occur. The other is financial. It doesn't always have to be more expensive, but for some people it can be more expensive, especially if you're not one who wants to give up grains and you're trying to go on, you know, you're trying to convert everything to its gluten-free equivalent. So you're still eating, you know, waffles and toast and cookies and all this other stuff that you probably shouldn't be eating anyway. But again, if you're someone coming from the more standard American diet and you're just trying to implement gluten to gluten-free, that could be a financial burden to you. So those are the two things that maybe we want to guard against. But let's talk about the studies. So we have the University of, I believe it's pronounced Monash, study that a problem. And it's important, I think, to kind of zoom out and look at what kind of evidence we have. So we have to date 5 randomized control trials looking at this issue. 4 of them have concluded that non-celiac gluten sensitivity is a legitimate issue. 1 has found that it may actually be the FODMAPs, and that's the Monash study. And that has been criticized because the control diet may not have been ample. They may not have had a high enough dose of the gluten. Some have criticized to cause a response. I don't even know how much that really matters when we take a broader look at the larger body of evidence. We have 5 randomized control trials that have looked at this, and 4 of them have found the non-celiac gluten sensitivity to be an issue. And of those 4, 2 of those have controlled for FODMAPs. Hmm. So a pretty simple look at the body of evidence at large, I think we can make a fairly confident evidence-based conclusion that yes, there is scientific, published, documented literature that really supports this concept of non-celiac gluten sensitivity, especially when you think about how some of these studies are done. For example, the one that I did a post on recently was entitled, and Rob, I'll send you at the end of our call, I'll just send you a bunch of links because I know people are going to ask for them anyway. So I'll just send you a bunch of links and I don't know if you can
Perfect.
Put them along.
Yeah, with the show I can notes put them all in there. Yep.
Okay. So this study was entitled Non-Celiac Gluten Sensitivity Has Narrowed the Spectrum of Irritable Bowel Syndrome, a Double-Blinded Randomized Placebo Control Trial. And essentially what they did is they took all these patients who had IBS and they put them on a gluten-free diet for about 6 weeks. Then they either gave them a placebo, which was a low FODMAP placebo, so they isolated for FODMAPs or they controlled for FODMAPs, or they gave them a gluten-containing pill. And so people didn't know what they were getting, and they controlled for FODMAPs, and they were given a 100-gram gluten placebo. And this 100 grams, but it actually contained about 50% gluten. So that's 50 grams. That's maybe like 10 pieces of bread. It's
I would definitely be shitting like a goose for like a year.
it's definitely a fair dose. And what they found, when these people went on a gluten-free diet, most patients experienced an improvement. When they then went on either the placebo or the control pill here, the gluten pill, the people taking the gluten, only 25% of those people maintained their improvement. So 75% of the people regressed essentially. The people that did not go on to gluten, about 85% of those people maintained their improvement. So are you with me on that?
Possibly a small section of folks were maybe reacting to the FODMAP part of that 85%, that the 15% that didn't improve, maybe some other confounder in there?
Well, there was no FODMAP in either.
Oh, there was no FODMAP in either one.
Yeah,
okay.
And that's what makes this study so important, because one of the first questions people will ask is, well, wasn't this disproven and wasn't it shown to be FODMAPs? And, you know, one person made a remark like that on Facebook, and he links to one study, and one study does not a case make, right? We really want to look at what the overall body of evidence suggests, because studies, you know, we can have a certain group, you can have a bias group, you can you don't want to put all your eggs in the basket of one study. So what I'm thinking there was that was the 25% of people that regressed even gluten-free, that may have just been an oscillation with those people. Mm-hmm. We can speculate as to why. I don't really know why, but I think the takeaway point is, when we take two groups, when we take one group of people and put them on a gluten-free diet, and then some people go back on gluten, and some people just take essentially a rice pill, which is what this was, that's FODMAP-free, the people that go on the gluten, most of them fall out. They feel terrible.
Regress, right.
They regress. And then the people that don't go on the gluten, most of those people continue to maintain the improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So it pretty definitively substantiates this concept that yes, non-celiac gluten sensitivity is a problem. But that being said, I don't think that means that everyone in the world needs to avoid gluten all the time, right? I was back east for a friend's wedding in the Boston area, and you know, I was in Rockport, Massachusetts, which is this, you know, coastal New England town outside of Boston, very, very working class. And I'm there with all the groomsmen, and they want to do a shot of Fireball, which is a terrible idea.
Right.
And they all want to do a thing of like Miller Lite. And so, you know, I partake because I know I can do that and I'll be fine, right? I can have some gluten and I won't fall off the ladder. And I did ask the waitress if they had any gluten-free beers, and you know, she kind of gave me a gluten-free beer. what is that? kind of thing. So I was like, all right, it's probably not going to work.
I'm going to get my ass kicked here really soon. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's just, you know, it's just important to, for people, I think, to experiment with this themselves and find out where they fall on the spectrum, because Rob, you and, my podcast host, Susan, you guys are at the end of the spectrum where you can't do any gluten, right? You have any and you're down for days. But then there's another end of the spectrum where people can have gluten and not really have much of a recourse. I still don't, as a personal practice, make gluten a part of my dietary staple, but I've tested the boundaries and I've seen that it doesn't really cause much of an issue for me. So I try to have that same narrative with patients, which is, all right, it's not a all or none sort of thing. It's not a gluten is, you know, gluten-free, non-celiac sensitive is right or wrong. It's that some people, yes, will certainly have a problem. Some will have an extreme problem, celiac. Some will have a more subtle problem, maybe non-celiac gluten sensitive. And then some can have some. And we need to get you healthy first and then have you go through the reintroduction and see where you're going to fall on this spectrum and then practice a level of avoidance that's, you know, that's in correspondence with your level of sensitivity.
That's crazy talk. Who would suggest such a thing?
It's just so unpractical, you know. Get nerdy again for a second. How does that sound to you? I wish we could just talk about this for 45 minutes and I could really impress people, but I think it's pretty easy. It's, you know, we look at the randomized control trials and, you know, it's a pretty straightforward kind of linear calculation, but anything there that you want to dig into?
No, it's great. And, you know, it's, if we had this conversation maybe 8 years ago, I would have probably been way more freaked out about it. I'm like, no, for the love of God, no gluten ever, you know, bringing up the social economic factors is a big deal. I mean, it's when I go out to eat and I'm like, hey, I'm going to be that person, you know, and I'm like, can you ask the chef when he cooks this, it's in a pan, it's not on the grill, that they grill French bread and blah, blah, blah. And some places are really good about it. Some places are terrible. We went to one place here for breakfast, maybe about three times, and each time they just completely shit the bed on putting the stuff together, and I was super sick afterwards. And that just sucks. And so if you don't really need to go through it, also it's just kind of a rigmarole. And if you don't have to go through that, then that's a big deal, you know?
Exactly. And that's what's nice about being in clinical practice, because I learn a lot from my patients and I listen to what they say. And some patients will tell me, you know, doc, you know, we've been gluten-free for a while. We've treated my gut. I'm feeling so much better. And I was at a bridal shower and I had some of the cake because I didn't want to be the person not to eat the cake. And I was really concerned about what was going to happen and I felt fine.
Right.
And I say, great. You know, that tells you, you know, where you fall on the spectrum, and just continue to observe and see if you can notice a certain threshold or what have you. Because yes, well, we can find evidence to show that some people will have terrific improvement gluten-free, people who are celiac, for example. It doesn't mean that everyone is going to experience terrific improvement from going gluten-free and that everyone has to adhere to a celiac level of avoidance.
Right.
And it's a textbook thing that happens in this space sometimes, is that if for the sickest of the sick, this treatment is good, then everyone should do this treatment. And that's a really flawed logic, right?
And I've gone down that rabbit hole a lot, whether you're talking about carbs and diabetes or, you know, just a variety of different things. You take that really extreme point and then back extrapolate it and assume that it fits everything, and it just clearly does not.
Exactly. And like you were mentioning, if we can save someone the social perils of that, then that can be significant, because I think in my clinical observation, one of the things that is most challenging for some patients is kind of getting back to living a more normal life, right? They get so zoomed into their health that they're not as present as a friend. They're letting go of hobbies and they're losing their grip on that other side of life that is so important to be healthy. Mm-hmm. And so if then they go to some sort of like gluten-free group or, you know, weekend seminar, and they get the bejesus scared out of them, that just reinforces this underlying like pseudo eating disorder that could really have some really costly social, ties to it.
Right. Absolutely. No, it's a fantastic point. It's one of these things that is an ongoing challenge, how to get kind of simple stories that you can convey to the masses and get them kind of moving 80% in the right direction. But then before you know it, those heuristics have been written down in stone and they become religious doctrine. And then when you start talking about nuance and, you know, well, this person might be able to get away with some gluten, this person can't, and here's the reasons why. And then it seems either contradictory or, you know, some sort of quasi-religious line has been drawn in the sand, and it's super frustrating on the one hand, I guess job security on the other hand. I don't know if we're ever going to figure that one out. So yeah.
Well, I've been trying to have this sort of logical way of working through these things with the ebook I've been working on for a while. The microbiota, it was going to be an article, and then now I think I'm at like 60 pages, so I think that's definitely too long for an article. But I review a multitude of different topics, and I just work through it in this way that, you know, here's just a logical way to approach this. Here's a reasonable approach that's not going to be, you know, evangelical or anything crazy like that. And I've had a few people read parts of it, just to kind of beta test if it was going to be absolute garbage or not. and I've gotten some really good feedback so far, which is like, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. It seems really reasonable, but also able to help people. And you know, like the artificial sweeteners was another thing I reviewed, the impact on the microbiota and weight and things like that. And, you know, I had a friend who, I got a Diet Coke one time at, I usually don't use artificial sweeteners, but I got a Diet Coke, and he goes, "You're going to drink that around me?" And he got personally offended. I was like, come on, man. Like, 'cause he was a super anti-artificial sweetener. And I'm not trying to, you know, do that. I mean, if you can just look at what happens and say, hey, here's a risk, here's a reward, here's a practical way of working through it, do what you want to do, right, sort of thing. So, for people that really want to get super jiggy with some of this stuff, there has been a proposed diagnostic criteria. I think you had posted something about this on Facebook, maybe, mm-hmm. Rob, the Salerno's expert criteria for diagnosing non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is pretty straightforward. It's just having someone go on a gluten-free diet. The other doctor would do this. Go on a gluten-free diet and then report back to your doctor's office, and he's going to give you either a placebo or a gluten pill and monitor you, and you're going to essentially do what we've been recommending to do in kind of the functional medicine community for a long time, which is elimination, reintroduction. Right. Who would have thought? You don't have to do, you know, $8,000 worth of lab testing to figure some of this stuff out.
Right.
And there's I'll put a link for that in the show notes. And there's also, and this would be for the people on the other side of the spectrum who want to spend like $10,000 to figure out if they're non-celiac gluten sensitive, but there has been a proposed diagnostic algorithm for working through and diagnosing. And you're going to have to poop and pee and be biopsied. And to me, it just doesn't seem worth all the rigmarole to figure out what you could probably do reasonably as accurately with just elimination reintroduction. But I'll put a link in there for people if they want to have a look at that.
Cool. Yeah. And I did throw that on my Facebook page with a little bit of the tongue in cheek deal of, you know, if this stuff doesn't exist, then why have these other people in 2015 developed a diagnostic criteria for it? So yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I don't know how we can have 5 randomized control trials, 4 of which are concluding this is a legitimate clinical entity, and people are still saying it's not legitimate. I mean, it's just, that's just probably your friend who's a moron who wants to go find one study from their armchair scientist perspective and then post that thinking that they've disproven a whole case, which is, I mean, that's just the kind of guy you want to punch in the face, essentially. Right. You know? I'm sorry, but
Doc, before we started recording, we talked a fair amount about just the gut biome itself, and there's definitely some push that you know, potentially getting a specific profile of microbiota could have certain health benefits. You and I have talked about that. There seems to be some really fast-acting lifestyle features, stress, blood glucose, shift work that can alter the microbiota. I've noticed that with the gluten sensitivity and just food sensitivities in general, it really is driven a lot by what's happening in the rest of the lifestyle. So somebody may be fine drinking a beer, like they can't eat bread, they can't do like pasta, but they can drink a beer because the gluten's been kind of fermented a little bit, but then they start doing shift work, they get real stressed out, and then the beer becomes a problem. Have you kind of seen that, and does it make sense within this spectrum of kind of immunoreactivity?
Yeah, I think what we're going to find with the microbiota is that lifestyle factors are going to be the most powerful way to influence that. And I know that's not good for the sensationalist microbiota crowd that are trying to sell fiber bars and probiotics and books. But if you really have a keen eye at the literature, you see that things like sleep, stress, even exposure to artificial sweeteners, they can have a very fast impact on your microbiota. And even things like optimizing your environment, like controlling blood sugar, can have a favorable impact on the microbiota. And there's even been some studies showing that people with celiac disease have increased microbiotal diversity, which I know people in the microbiota camp are probably yelling blasphemy when I say that, but there have been published studies showing that those with celiac have increased microbiota diversity. And by going on a gluten-free diet, we see that diversity become a little bit less diverse and start to shift more toward a healthy control sort of microbiota.
Hmm.
So, I think one of the bottom line things we see is that for the niche of opinion forming around microbiota information, we see a niche there thinking that prebiotics are just like the next best thing in the universe. And one of the things I've done as part of this ebook that I'm writing is a section that is boringly entitled Review of Interventions, where I look at IBS, IBD, celiac, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, autoimmunity, where evidence is available. And I pick apart all of the clinical trials and I say there have been 8 randomized controlled trials using prebiotics as a treatment for inflammatory bowel disease. Here's what's been found. Because that is what is going to matter, right? If you have IBD and you want to know if a prebiotic is going to help you, we want to see what will happen if we take 400 people, put them on this prebiotic, and track their IBD. I don't give a crap about what sort of bacteria population shifted or what sort of cool anti-inflammatory mechanism was facilitated, because to me, I want to know what is a clinical effect going to be, right? And I shouldn't say I don't give a crap, but I admittedly am venting some frustration here because I see people taking a mouse model prebiotic study that showed a shift in some sort of inflammatory peptide. And then they extrapolate from that, because that happened and inflammation is higher in Crohn's disease, we should be giving people with Crohn's disease this prebiotic. When at the same time, we have clinical trials where that's been done and there has been no effect or maybe even a worsening of the Crohn's disease. And these are people who need to have their scientific card revoked, right? Because it's, come on.
Doc, what you know, some folks that I've talked to, some folks that I listen to, they will go back and say, okay, well, we need to do like some SIBO testing. We need to see if we've got small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, biofilms, all that type of stuff. Is this where it gets really complex? You know, so on the one hand, we're wanting folks to, you know, enact these simple, you know, say like elimination, reintroduction diets, figure out what's going on. If that doesn't fix things, or we're not getting, you know, kind of a good story with that, you know, there seems to also be this real fear of having people eat a lower carb diet these days because of fear that they're going to starve the commensal bacteria and production of like mucus in the gut, and that we're going to buy ourselves a little bit of upside on the front end, but then all kinds of big problems on the back end. What's kind of your clinical algorithm for moving people through this and stepping up to looking at like SIBO testing and whatnot?
Well, yeah, thank you for getting me off my soapbox there before I put my foot too far in my mouth.
This show, only 6 people listen to it, so it can't be too bad. So
I only get 6 hate mail, so that'll be manageable, I guess.
Perfect.
I just wrote an article. I haven't released it yet, but I'll be releasing this on my website soon. I'll probably entitle it "Should You Be Gluten-Free?" And I kind of run through this whole thing of gluten-free, yes or no, non-celiac gluten sensitivity, yes or no. And then if you've done that and you're not feeling any better, what do we do next? And it's a pretty practical algorithm, but we start with diet and then we reevaluate. If after diet someone is still symptomatic, then I think for most people, the next best step, not a rule, not 100% of the time, but for most people, a really thorough gut evaluation is going to be important. Because, for example, if someone still has IBS symptoms, that may be caused by SIBO. Because many cases, of SIBO, or I'm sorry, of IBS have been shown to be caused by SIBO. The highest percentage I've seen published has been 84%. But again, it's important to remember that you want to change your diet first, because this could solely respond to just improving your diet, these symptoms. But if you've changed your diet, change your lifestyle, you're still not feeling well, a thorough gut evaluation is usually a good idea. SIBO breath test, very important for that. You want to have lactulose provoked. You want to measure methane and hydrogen. You want to do it for at least 3 hours. Because if you don't, you may miss some cases. Glucose is not a good reagent to use, because glucose gets absorbed in the first few feet of the small intestine. And if you have SIBO that's more distal toward the colonic end, you'll miss that colony and you'll be false negative for SIBO. So definitely a thorough gut evaluation. SIBO is certainly an important one, probably the most common thing that I find. But there's also Candida, which is, I think maybe 10 years ago, Candida kind of hit its peak where it was blamed for, I think, everything under the sun.
Right.
And now we're kind of realizing, yes, it's important, but it's not the only, you know, player in town, so to speak. But Candida, definitely. And you can do that in stool culture. And you can also do it via antibody. And I actually have been looking more closely at the antibody lately, because there is this new diagnosis emerging known as SIFO, small intestinal fungal overgrowth. And we don't have a test for it right now other than jejunal aspirate, which is shove a tube down your nose, throat, stomach into your small intestine, extract some fluid and test that. Not really the thing I'd want to be doing on a Tuesday afternoon, right? So I think we'll have testing for that hopefully in the next few years. It'd be great if there was a breath test for that. But you know, we're waiting on that. What do we have that we could use? Well, it's not official. It's not even been studied. It's just we don't have anything. So what is the best thing we could maybe conjecture could be helpful? And that's where I look at the antibodies that can be done via blood testing, via Quest or LabCorp. And so if I see a stool culture negative for fungus, that tells you there's probably nothing in the colon. But if I see the antibodies positive, then again, it's not official, but I'm looking at that as that person probably has SIFO or small intestinal fungal overgrowth. So that's a nifty and a novel one. And doing a really thorough battery of testing is important, and good testing is really important. And it's, I mean, it's way beyond kind of the scope of this call to go into all of that. But as we've discussed in the past, there are some labs that are not very good. And without giving any names, one of the more popular functional medicine labs, in my opinion, has one of the worst stool tests I've ever seen. And I don't say that trying to be a jerk. I say that as someone that I run stool tests side by side in most of my patients. And I started to notice this relationship that a certain lab was missing infections over 75% of the time while the other lab was finding them. And so after doing that for over 6 months, maybe even a year, I've kind of just given up on the one lab because things were being missed. And what's been unfortunate for some of the patients that come in, you know, patient John Doe comes in, he said, I went to functional medicine person XYZ and they did this really expensive gut test and I came back normal. And I look at that test and inside my head, I'm like, this test is crap. And so we do better testing and we find an infection and we treat that infection and said patient gets a lot better. So good testing is really important. I don't mean to sound overly crass there, but it's unfortunate when patients, especially if they're paying out of pocket for these things, are doing testing that has really just not been shown to be very accurate. Because if you miss a gut infection, gosh, I mean, if I had missed my amoebic infection, I'd be a basket case right now, right? Because it was causing so many problems. So again, please don't misinterpret my whatever emotion I'm portraying right now. Please don't misconstrue that as me being critical of other people. It's just me really caring about the patient getting a good test, a good diagnosis, and the treatment that they need. One other one that may be important, another organism that's kind of important, toxoplasmosis. I've seen more and more of that in the clinic, and I actually recently came across a paper, and this is really interesting actually, that showed that toxoplasmosis induced an increase in anti-gluten antibodies. So after someone had a toxoplasmosis infection that seemed to change the immune system in such a way it started reacting against gluten. So that's a really interesting little bugger. And there's a few different tests you can do for that. Usually it's a blood antibody profile. And there is a test called toxoplasmosis agglutination that's kind of a verification that is maybe more accurate than the antibodies, but it's kind of hard to get clinically. So I haven't been using that in the clinic just yet, but that's one. If a clinician is listening, it's not part of your workup, I'd say make sure you start including that. And if you're a patient, if you haven't been tested for that, you may want to look into that one amongst some of the others. But unfortunately, there's too many to kind of name off.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's interesting. I know like Toxoplasma gondii is a concerning feature for pregnant women, like if you own a cat and cleaning a litter box and all that type of stuff, because there can be some problems there. But I had no idea it had any potential modification on gluten reactivity. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I didn't either until a few months ago. And I spend about, on most days, I spend an hour reading the recently published abstracts on a number of different topics in PubMed. And it's really helpful to pick out new things that are emerging. Like for inflammatory bowel disease that's non-responsive to steroids and other stronger drugs, people may actually have a cytomegalovirus infection. It's been shown to be one of the underlying causes of recalcitrant or non-steroid responsive IBD. Hmm. And so that's really impressive. And a group published a kind of a biopsy guideline for determining if that's an issue. So there's lots of little things I pull out from doing that. It only cost me every night of my life socializing with friends, so it's worth it.
You give and you give.
Right, yeah. But if people – I don't know if people have caught this, but the Friday edition now of my newsletter, it's essentially – seven or eight studies with like a, one sentence blurb about it that I've picked out of the recent medical literature. So that's, if people want to geek out on some of this stuff, that could be a nice thing to plug into to get this.
Nice.
There's one other thing I wanted to mention. Oh yeah. So with the microbiota, it has been shown that if you have an infection, that infection will cause, of course, inflammation, and that inflammation will cause microbiota dysbiosis. And what seems to happen is that when you have an infection, inflammation, more pathogenic species of bacteria can live in that higher inflammatory environment. And so if you have inflammation, that inflammation can cause dysbiosis. So let's say you have a toxoplasmosis infection. The toxoplasmosis can be causing inflammation. That inflammation can cause other families of bacteria to overgrow because these bacteria have evolved to be able to live in a higher inflammatory environment, so to speak. So it's been shown with Salmonella, for example, in certain enterobacteria species. And so it reinforces my posit that the key to this is in testing the phylotypes, if you will, but it's removing any offenders and optimizing the environment so you can allow the colony to express itself or to balance itself back out.
Totally makes sense. Doc, what, so for someone like me where I've still been fiddling with this, I feel great on a ketogenic diet, good cognition, kind of blood sugar swings when I consume more carbs, but that higher carb intake seems to help with athletic performance. Like, where would you walk me through this stuff? Like, clearly the gluten box ticked, like pretty right. pretty unequivocal on that. But where would you go with someone like me as kind of the next step? It I guess is one question. Then another question, I've been really getting a sense from some folks out in the blogosphere that optimally running on a low carb diet, if that's what you think you're doing, it's actually just indication that there's something broken. Everybody should be able to run fantastically on a higher carb diet. If they get their gut microbes buttoned up, then that's going to be a non-issue. So I guess two things, maybe starting with that first one.
Right.
I mean, I had a vaginal birth, no breastfeeding, antibiotics all throughout my adolescence. I was on tetracycline for like 8 years for acne. And so I'm just kind of thinking maybe my guts are just kind of hammered and, you know, right. that's just kind of where I'm at. And I'm going to have to eat a lower carb diet to be able to, you know, manage or mitigate that. Like, what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, thank you for kind of steering me back here, because I didn't really do a great job of answering fully your question about, you know, what's the clinical kind of process I take people through, which answers this question. So first would be diet and lifestyle, like we talked about. Then would be a gut evaluation and treating anything that you find there, which is definitely sometimes easier said than done. But then once we have cleared out any infection, treated any sort of inflammatory syndrome, what have you, gotten things rebalanced, the gut's healed, everything there is good, then I have people go through a reintroduction, right, of potential allergens. So people bring back in dairy. Some people can do it. Some people can. Eggs, they'll bring back in nuts, beans. So they'll bring back in these foods, and we'll try to get someone on the broadest diet that we can. After we do, or kind of in tandem with the food reintroduction, I have people go through a carbohydrate reintroduction. And I think Sisson, someone told me that Sisson has something similar that he recommends, is like the carbohydrate curve or something mm-hmm, like that. Mm-hmm. But essentially, we want to have people see what they can get away with in terms of their carb intake, right? Because I've clearly seen in the clinic that I'd say 70% of people do better on a little bit lower of a carb diet, not crazy low, but maybe, you know, somewhere between 70, 120 grams a day. But I've also seen for maybe 30% of people, they're doing low carb and it's making them ill. They have high blood sugar, they have low testosterone, they have high cholesterol. And I'll tell them, I want you to eat at least 150 grams of carbs every day. And their blood sugar goes down, their cholesterol goes down. So we can't discount that. I think it has to do with a concept that Christopher Gardner has pioneered. So there's a metabolic answer, and there's a gut answer. The metabolic answer, I think Christopher Gardner has pioneered, and I know me and you talked about him coming on my podcast soon, which I'm super excited about because I think he's really onto something. But he's published a concept known as heterogeneity of insulin sensitivity, which is a big word for saying some people process sugar better than others. Right. Mm-hmm. But what he did in one of his studies, a study called the A to Z weight loss trial, they put people on the Atkins diet, the Ornish diet, the Learn diet, or the Zone diet. So they put people on a spectrum of high carb diets to low carb diets. And what they found was that some people could lose weight on any diet and other people could only lose weight on a low carb diet. So they did more analysis and they analyzed what sort of glucose tolerance do these people have or how well do they process blood sugar and insulin. And they found that the people that only responded or could only lose weight on the low-carb diet seemed to have poor insulin sensitivity. But the people that could lose weight on any diet have good insulin sensitivity. So this may be a genetic phenomena. Certainly there are probably lifestyle and exercise factors that play into this, yes. But this also may be a genetic or maybe even an ancestral phenomenon. Because remember, there is what's called a latitudinal discrepancy in carbohydrate consumption. The closer to the equator you get, at least from an evolutionary perspective, usually the more carb-rich the diet, the closer to the poles you get, usually the more carb-sparse or fat-rich the diet is. So if you're of Northern European descent, it's not totally crazy to make the argument that you may do better on a moderate to lower carbohydrate diet, whereas someone who's a Pacific Islander may do better on a higher carbohydrate diet. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the metabolic answer. And then there's also kind of the gut answer. And I think this comes down to, and I heard your podcast with the Perfect Health Diet.
Paul Jaminet.
Paul Jaminet, yeah. Thank you. And I liked his perspective, and I agree with, when people's guts are in rough shape, a lot of times they are going to do better on a lower carbohydrate diet to start. And that's why clinically I start people on a lower carb diet, and then eventually when they're healthier, I have them open up and see where they fall on the carb spectrum. But definitely, conditions like SIBO, for example, they will do better usually on a lower carb diet. But there's more to it than just SIBO. So there's also the fungal piece, right? And so some people notice they have kind of candidal symptoms sometimes if they eat too much carbs. And candida symptoms and SIBO symptoms have so much overlap, it's hard to distinguish between the two. But here's what I'm driving at. There are certain people that have polymorphisms, and there's two polymorphisms. There's numerous we know about, but two in particular I think have been fairly well studied, Dectin-1 and CARD-9. And these polymorphisms, they detract from your ability to regulate fungal growth in the intestines. And so these people seem to have a higher predilection genetically to have fungus overgrow. And so if they were to eat a diet that is higher in sugar and carbs that can feed fungus, they're at a higher risk for this overgrowth. And it's interesting that other studies have correlated these genes or these polymorphisms with an increased risk of inflammatory bowel disease. And if we look further, one of the things that is attacked in some forms of inflammatory bowel disease is Saccharomyces cerevisiae antibodies, or a fungal antibody, probably because these genes don't regulate the growth of that, of the Saccharomyces cerevisiae. The Saccharomyces cerevisiae overgrows, the immune system starts attacking, and we have IBD. So it's complicated, right? But it's also really simple. Work through the kind of model I'm outlining here, which is start with diet and lifestyle. If that doesn't work, next thing I would do is have a very good gut evaluation. And if you improve from that, give yourself a couple months, and then go into this food reintroduction and then carbohydrate reintroduction, and listen to your body along that process, and you will settle into your allowable food allergens and your allowable carbohydrate intake that you'll do best on. And I really think that's this clinical model that I was talking about, where we try to account for all these things and make sure we minimize harm and maximize benefit. We account for all these different things through that clinical model. Right, it sounds confusing. What is my insulin sensitivity? Do I have Dectin-1, CARD-9? Do I have SIBO? Do I need more carbs, less carbs? But if you work through this model, you really help address all of those things. And so, the what to do is a lot simpler than the why we're doing it. But it's fortunate for people that you don't have to really know a whole lot about why we're doing it. Right?
Just empirically experiment and take it incrementally. Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, that's not going to fix every problem for every person, but it's a really good starting point, I think.
No, that's great. That's great. It's just the continual peeling of the onion for me, trying to figure all this stuff out. Both of my parents were type 2 diabetic, died from type 2 diabetes and autoimmunity complications. I can't think of anybody in my family that's not type 2 diabetic at this point. And right. So there's a, and clearly not spectacular diet, low movement and all that type of stuff. But it's just a family of doughy Northern Europeaners. And I was kind of the only one that really went into this lower carb way of eating. And that was just this completely life transforming event for me, like basically doing a cyclic low carb diet. And so I've been fiddling with that over the course of about 15 years, but still trying to figure out what the optimum air fuel mixture is on that.
And you were saying when you're lower carb, you have better cognition, but when you have a little bit more carb, you have better training output. Is that
exactly? Right? Yep. And some of the folks on the more ketogenic diet side of things, they say, I just need to go longer, better keto adapt. There's some interesting stuff that's come out of the Finney and Volek research that shows that, when people adequately fat adapt, we may have like 150, 200% more ability to oxidize fat than what has historically been thought to be achievable and whatnot. So I've bounced back and forth in that. But then there's also this other side of, apparently you need to provide enough fermentable carbohydrates so that the gut lining doesn't get damaged from lack of mucosal production and those sorts of things. So it's, for me personally, it's I feel more confused and lost today than I did about 10 years ago.
I think the scenario that you've fallen into in terms of what you're doing for your own health, I think it illustrates a really good point, because you're certainly feeling a lot better than you were back when the wheels fell off, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And from what you've told me, you have a little bit more carbs on the days that you train.
Right.
And the days that you don't train, you have a little bit less carbs. And you seem, I mean, at least from what I've seen, you seem like you're very coherent and alive and vital, and you've got a great voice. So that's something to go with for radio. But I mean, you seem like you're overall doing really, really well, probably better than most. And yeah, you have maybe a little thing here or there that seems like it can improve a little bit. But I think that's part of being a growth-oriented person is you're aware of what could be better. And it's both a gift and a curse, right? It keeps you striving, but it also keeps you noticing things that aren't at 100%. And so is that 100% even ever achievable? I don't know. And so I think your case is actually a great one where you've fallen into this pattern that works for you through your own observation. And it's important, I think, for people just to know that, yeah, even guys like Rob Wolf, this internationally acclaimed celebrity for paleo, still has little things that bug him. And you shouldn't expect that, you know, you would be any different than him. Meaning, you know, if he can't have it 100% perfect, feeling like a god all the time, then it's probably not a realistic expectation to feel that way.
Well, but unless I ate 30 bananas a day, in which case everything would be good.
You know, but I think sometimes we get so asphyxiated upon the 4% improvement, right, that we could get to 100, we forget how lucky we are and how great we're doing and everything else. So it's not to say that maybe you couldn't get a little more improvement out of what you're doing, but you know, you've fallen into kind of that carbohydrate ratio and the allergen ratio that works for you through your own observation. But I guess that one question though, Rob, have you ever been tested for SIBO? Have you ever been tested for, a full gut profile? And have you tracked things like lactoferrin and calprotectin that are very important for IBD and inflammation in the gut?
I have not. So maybe that's our homework that I'll work with you on, and then we'll bring you back on and we'll do some analysis on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a little bit of low-hanging fruit there. And I'm sorry if you don't want to share this, but
no.
Have you ever been diagnosed? Were you diagnosed with IBD ever?
No, or the only thing I was diagnosed with was Crohn's disease. And, you know, interestingly, the celiac diagnosis was inconclusive. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of antibody titer, but I had really dropped off on consumption, and I really didn't feel motivated to eat enough to be able to get that titer. And then if I wasn't consuming it, then even like the scoping wasn't going to work. My mother, you know, that's interesting stuff though, because I ate gluten as a kid, and I don't think I felt great from it, but it was nothing like what it is now. And that was a similar story for my mom. And I did some reading related to like Giardia exposure and that being a precipitator for full blown celiac type symptoms, which sounds maybe similar to the Cryptosporidium or the other organism that you mentioned in triggering a more full blown celiac issues. So yeah. I mean, the only thing I've been officially diagnosed with was Crohn's disease back in like 96, 97. Managed to put that in remission. If I'm largely gluten free, then I'm good to go as far as that is concerned.
So with your gut, then one of the things I would want to look at would be your Crohn's antibodies, and then also look at lactoferrin and calprotectin have been shown to be very good clinical corollaries, and especially that they can predict relapse of IBD. And just looking at those may be really important to see how your gut's looking. And who knows, you may benefit from a low dose herbal anti-inflammatory to kind of help push those things a little bit more, if some of those inflammatory markers or antibodies are elevated, to push those down a little bit more, because there may be just a little bit of immune activation that may be provocating, you know, these transient gut problems that you're having. And that may come back to you, interestingly, like the Dectin-1 and CARD-9, maybe you have those and that's throwing off your ability to regulate fungus. And that's why you notice some of these things get funky when you start having too much carbs.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? It could all be quackery, but that's what I think anyway.
Oh, well, it's all pseudoscience at a minimum, so that's for sure. Well, Doc, I don't want to chew up your whole day. I know that you're super busy. Remind folks where they can find you, and also, when is this new ebook going to be available?
Well, I'm hoping to I just looked at the date. I was going to say I'm hoping to finish it up by the end of September, and it's already the 24th. I'm hoping it'll be done within a few weeks. It's been challenging though, because I'm really writing this in a no BS way. The things that I'm writing, we're looking through a tremendous amount of studies. We're distilling it down to the practical pieces, and we're trying to write in such a way that it reads like a story rather than like a medical journal. So it takes a surprising amount of time to do that. But I'm shooting to have that release within the next month or two.
Awesome.
And I think it'll be really helpful for people, because a lot of these things that we've been talking about, I pick apart, and I'm just trying to give people a really practical, non-BS, non-sensational view of the microbiota and your gut health and some of the simple things that you can do. So hopefully soon, but I almost feel like it's you're running toward the finish line, and every step you take, someone's pulling the finish line further and further away from you.
Yes, that is definitely publishing, seems like. So Yeah, totally. And so drrusho.com, is that where you hang most of your shingles?
Yeah. Yes, drrusho.com. We usually put out a piece every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Right now, Monday is usually a video. Wednesdays is a podcast. Friday is what we call our Rusho's wrap-up. It's just those research highlights and other things. And then there's a few interesting articles coming down the line. There's that one on celiac that I mentioned. There's obviously the microbiota ebook. And then something else, if I have time to do, I'd like to write something up on is timing of introduction of gluten into a child's diet and what effect that might have on future risk for celiac disease. Mm. It's some interesting stuff being published there. That's the lion's share of it.
Cool. Very cool. Well, Doc, it's been great having you on again. Always super interesting. And let's do an experiment on me and see what we can figure out. And then we'll come back on the show and we'll let everybody know that I have like 6 months to live.
Yeah.
I'll do an Andy Kaufman, and it'll be like, did he fake his death? Is he really dead? I don't know. So
maybe we could both fake our deaths and move to an island in like Honduras or something and just surf all day and, you know, spearfish.
I am all over that.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I am all over that. Okay. Awesome, Doc. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Bye-bye.